part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required and individuals can join at any time. For more information, call 384-5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of our program, we'll be talking about Pakistan, some about its past and reflecting on its future or possible futures. And our guest for the program is Stephen Cohen. He has been following the history and the politics of Pakistan for a long time, Pakistan and India both. He has been a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution since 1998. Before that, he was faculty member here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He was one of the founders and former director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. Before his coming to the University of Illinois, he was scholar in residence at the Ford Foundation, New Delhi, and before that was member of the policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of State, where he dealt with South Asia. He's written a good deal about India and Pakistan. A recent book titled India, Emerging Power, that was published in June of 2001. He's also written about both the Pakistan Army and the Indian Army. He has a new book that's just out, which is titled The Idea of Pakistan. It's published by the Brookings Institution Press. And he's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning to talk about Pakistan from Brookings. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is that people who call in are brief, if they can be, brief as they can be, just so that we can keep the program moving along and also include as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. At any point, feel free to join the conversation. Stephen Cohen, hello.
It's great to be back with you. Great to be back in Illinois, if only by remote broadcast.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. You've been pretty generous with us over the years, both since you've been in Washington and going back to the time that you were actually here in Champaign-Urbana. So we're always glad to have the opportunity to talk with you. And I guess I should say, I think Stephen Cohen is someone who is generally regarded as being one of the best informed observers of the politics of this region in the United States. So that's why we continue to ask him to be on the show and talk about
it. Well, that may mean only that I think I know what I don't know, which is a great deal.
Well, the book, The Idea of Pakistan, is focused on Pakistan and perceptions of Pakistanis, particularly people who are in leadership positions over time, how it is they think about their country. Before looking at that, though, just to step back a little bit, I think that it is true that if you ask people who are somewhat informed about the world and world events, ask them, where are the places around the world that are potential flashpoints? I'm sure that on a lot of people's list, Pakistan will be near the top because of the longstanding tensions with India, because of the fact that both Pakistan and India have demonstrated the capability to build nuclear weapons, because of the fact that there are a number of militant Islamist groups operating in Pakistan, and also because of the fact that in recent years, even the leader of the country, Pervez Musharraf, more than once there have been attempts on his life. All of that taken together, you would have to say there is certainly potential for a problem there that could spread further. Now, having said all of that, do we overstate the danger that this country poses to itself, its neighbors, and the rest of the world?
I think I think the estimates, and you've listed the big issues. I think they're slightly skewed, in that I wouldn't argue that, say, an attempt on Musharraf, a successful attempt on Musharraf, would threaten American vital interests, but the other issues are that important. I think Pakistan is more stable than people let on to be. In fact, the Pakistan government has an interest in exaggerating the instability and the danger of the country. But you are generally right, and the 9/11 Commission in its report indicated three countries of primary concern to the United States, and they were Afghanistan, of course, where the Taliban were located and where al-Qaeda was based, Saudi Arabia, which funded much of this and which is a big oil producer, but also potentially a very unstable state, and Pakistan, which, as you said, is not only a potentially unstable state, but the propagator of radical Islam and terrorism, and also possession of at least 30 or 40 nuclear weapons. In fact, it's even since I've written the book, or as I was just concluding it, we've discovered that Dr. A.Q. Khan, the mad genius of Pakistani nuclear program, has been going around the world sharing nuclear technology with other countries.
Mm. The book, one of the large questions the book raises is, how close has Pakistan come to fulfilling its promise, going back to the sort of vision articulated by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the man who was the first head of state and who was generally considered to be the founder of the country. Going back then to what he and people at that time were talking about, what was their idea of what Pakistan could be?
Yeah, I think that it's often misunderstood and certainly misrepresented both by Pakistanis, by Indians, and misunderstood by Americans. I think you see, the founding idea of Pakistan, the idea in which the movement was based, was really similar to the idea of two other countries, or perhaps three if you add Bosnia, and that is Pakistan was to be a homeland for what was thought to be, by them at least, as a persecuted religious minority. And two other major states have had that same origin. One, of course, was Israel, which was founded not so much on the basis of Zionism, but really on the basis that Jews had been persecuted throughout the world, and Israel was the logical place for persecuted Jews or fearful Jews to move to. And the other, of course, was America. America was founded by religious minorities or threatened religious groups, largely from Great Britain, both Protestant and Catholic, and they saw in America a place where they could practice the religion unhindered by the state. Of course, America then became a homeland to other persecuted groups from around the world, and that's one of our defining characteristics. But Pakistan really was founded as a homeland, a separate homeland for persecuted this has to be put very carefully because it's often misunderstood. It was founded as a homeland for Indian Muslims who felt persecuted or threatened by a dominant Hindu majority. Now, the irony of this, of course, is that not all Indian Muslims went to Pakistan and not all felt persecuted. In fact, almost as many Indian Muslims in India today as are Pakistanis today. And that's one of the ironies of Pakistan's very identity.
Hmm. Well, I think one of the observations you make is that that they're really yes, indeed, there was that idea, and perhaps various people did have some ideas about what Pakistan was supposed to be. And yet it seems that after the country, and you write as much in the book, that after the country became independent, there really was no consensus about what Pakistan was to be, and that in that vacuum stepped the military, and the military essentially has run the country ever since.
Sure, that's right. And the military had its own notion of what Pakistan should be, or the idea of Pakistan. But the analogy with Israel and with the United States is very interesting. In Israel, there's a contest among Israelis as to what Israel should be and the degree to which Israel should be a Jewish state that is guided by the basic precepts laid down in the Old Testament. And in America, of course, there are those who argue that America is a Christian state or Judeo-Christian state to be guided by the Bible or Old and the New Testament. And I think this is one aspect of the debate in Pakistan. The original idea of Pakistan as a homeland for persecuted Indian Muslims was to be a democracy, a democratic state where minorities would live freely and openly. And Jinnah was very, very strong on emphasizing the importance of protecting Pakistan's new Christian, Hindu, and Buddhist minorities. The military has a different view. And then the third group that's of significance, of course, is the Islamists, who have a more radical view of what kind of country Pakistan should be.
Hmm. Why is it, I guess, I'm again moved to ask about why it is that there wasn't sufficient sort of strength or cohesion among people who weren't associated either with the military or with the Islamists to manage to create some sort of consistent vision and leave that vacuum that allowed the military to step in. I mean, what really was happening?
I think that the chief factor is the instability that hit Pakistan as soon as it was born. Here the comparison with India is appropriate. Unlike India, which had strong, powerful leadership and narrow living until 1964, Jinnah died very quickly, and Jinnah had no large cadre of followers who could really step into his shoes and perpetuate his dream. Secondly, the Pakistanis were involved in a war with India itself over Kashmir, and this drained their resources and also brought the military to the forefront. And thirdly, the Pakistan government decided that because it was such a weak country and India was really doing its best to ensure that Pakistan would not survive, that it had to turn to the West and to other countries, particularly America and United Kingdom, for military support. So the military and defense issues became very important in Pakistan very early. And there was no significant civilian counterparts to counterbalance that military influence. So as the Pakistan army grew in maturity and grew in age, they became politically more important until Ayub Khan simply declared a coup d'etat and took over in the 1950s.
Despite the admittedly very difficult and divisive issue of religion, is there a sense in which Pakistan is culturally distinct from India, or would you have to say in all other ways, aside from the fact that it was created to be this refuge for Muslims, that in all other respects there really is no significant difference between India and Pakistan?
Well, you know, that's a view that's often asserted by Indians, and I've been at meetings where Indian politicians and spokesmen have stood up and say, well, you Pakistanis and we Indians, we're just pretty much the same kind of people, at which time I look at the Pakistanis, and they cringe because they desperately want to have their own separate identity. In fact, Pakistan does have significant overlap with India, but not as significant as some Indians would assert. Obviously, the Punjab has a culture and a language common to both India and Pakistan. In the partition, Punjab was divided into two, and there's an Indian portion and a Pakistani portion. But some of the other Pakistani provinces are quite different, and there's no exact counterpart in India. For example, the Northwest Frontier province is primarily a tribal society, and there's zero overlap with India. The overlap in the NWFP, of course, is with Afghanistan, where the tribes spill over into Afghanistan. Sindh has some overlap with India. And of course, in Karachi, there's Muhajirs, that is, emigres from India, and they do have cultural, civilizational overlap with India. So I do think there's some overlap, but clearly the Pakistanis have tried to create a separate identity. And this is often seen in the area of popular culture and this tension between what is Indian and what is Pakistani and what perhaps is Islamic is seen very much in popular society and popular culture. For example, the cricket matches are in a sense, a mini war between India and Pakistan. Yet this last round of cricket matches, when the Indians came to Pakistan, they were greeted with great hospitality by the Pakistanis, who also graciously lost to the Indian team. In films, the Pakistanis are crazy about Indian films. They just love them, and their own film industry is sort of stagnating. But the mullahs don't like Indian films and Indian culture and have declared kite flying, which is, you know, I think, a subcontinental practice, to be un-Islamic. So you do get this tension in these debates going on in Pakistan. And I'd say that's pretty much the case of Israel. And again, there's analogies between Pakistan and Israel as to what kind of criteria should be applied. And of course, many Israelis overlap culturally with some of their neighbors, although also with Europeans.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stephen Cohen. He's a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and for a long time has been following the politics of both India and Pakistan. He's authored the book India Emerging Power, which was published by Brookings in 2001, and now a new book that is sort of companion, but not really, a book entitled The Idea of Pakistan. It is also published by Brookings. It's out now. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In what ways has the United States made Pakistan the place that it is?
That's the right way to ask the question. It's hard to answer. In fact, it deserves a book of its own. Many Pakistanis assume that we control everything that happens in Pakistan. I think many American officials sort of stand back and wonder and try and figure out how we can influence Pakistan at all. In fact, the American government has had a long and deep influence in the development of Pakistan, a particularly important role in Pakistani politics. And that's primarily because we've seen Pakistan as a frontline state first against communist China and red and the Soviet Union, then in Afghanistan against the Soviets who invaded Afghanistan, and now we see Pakistan as a frontline state in the war on terrorism. In each of those alliances, the Pakistanis have used us, you know, knowingly and consciously, while we've been aware of how they've used us. But I don't think that there's been a deep, close relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan at the strategic level, even though there's these intermittent marriages. What has happened, however, is that over the years, Pakistanis turned to the United States, perhaps more than Great Britain in recent years, for education, for culture, for investment, and a place to send their children and so forth. And I think there's been a cultural influence of the United States on Pakistan, which is quite impressive. Yet in the past 3 years after 9/11, that's been broken, and Pakistanis are deeply estranged from America. They no longer see us as their friend and their ally. In fact, they're very hostile to the U.S. and particularly to the way in which they think we've treated the Muslim world and Pakistan in particular.
Criticism has been made of the United States in the sense that our policy has been inconsistent to the degree that we might indeed have our own agenda, that we also have this idea that stability in that country, in that region is a good thing, and that here and now and again we've pressed whatever advantage that we've had, and yet other events have come into the mix, and we have decided that we needed the cooperation of the government in Pakistan, and so then we would lay off. So has there indeed been any sort of consistent policy of the United States in regards to Pakistan?
I think that's a legitimate accusation against the U.S. I think our policy has been to get along with whoever's in power and then not really push Pakistan towards democratization. And ironically, many in the military would like to see Pakistan democratized. You know, they just don't think Pakistan is capable of doing it. But I do think various American administrations have not pushed this hard enough. But really, you know, the problem is that of Pakistan. You can't impose a democracy. And when a society has refused to undertake major land reform, when it's really governed by an oligarchy of perhaps 1,000 people at the top, you know, democracy isn't going to work terribly well. You know, mm-hmm. Pakistan is sort of stuck between wanting to be a democracy and being a functional establishment or oligarchy. And there's not much the U.S. can do to change that. But there are things we should be doing, I think. And my only quibble with the present Bush administration is that they're not quite doing enough. And I think much of our programs aim towards the democratization of Pakistan, development of Pakistani institutions, special education, really are not enough. We should be doing much more in that area.
You talked a little bit earlier. We talked about the fact that the military in Pakistan has always been the most powerful group organization in the country. Just recently, we passed the fifth anniversary of the takeover by General Musharraf, who continues to be both the leader of the military and the president, even though he said that he was going to be stepping down as the leader of the military. Now, just recently, I think there has been some legislation passed that would allow him to continue, at least for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But he had at one point promised that by the end of this year he would quit as the head of the military. So now it looks like that's not going to happen. the question I'm going for is in what sorts of ways does the Pakistani military exercise control and influence over the government?
Well, they've increasingly penetrated into Pakistani society after every coup. You know, there have been four major military governments in Pakistan: Ayub Khan, Yahya Khan, Zia-ul Haq, and Musharraf. And after each military intervention, the military find itself deeper and deeper involved in Pakistani society and politics. The recent development has been that the army itself has been drawn into business and commercial affairs. In fact, Nawaz Sharif, the civilian, brought them in some significant ways. And the army's increasingly equivalent to the Pakistani economy. There's large government or military foundations run by military officers. And furthermore, the army has weakened the power of the civilian bureaucracy systematically, and particularly this has been accelerated under Musharraf. So I think that the final way in which the army exercises its influence, besides directly taking over, is through the operation of its intelligence services. In each Pakistani district, especially where there are army units. The local area commander and his intelligence apparatus has a lot to say about what happens in that district. They can determine who's going to get elected, who's going to be powerful, who's going to be weak. So the army has a vast network of intelligence and political influence within Pakistan itself. And that's not exceptional. That happens in a lot of other countries, but few other countries have the weaknesses that Pakistan faces, and I don't think the army has the qualifications or the ability to really, you know, to run a country. They can run an army fairly well, but to run a country requires different set of skills and different outlook on life, which I don't think most officers have.
Generally speaking, how do you think that Pervez Musharraf has done as leader of the country?
Oh, if I would give him a grade at, say, when I if he was a student at the U of I, I'd give him C+, B-. He's a disappointment in a sense, but maybe he's operating up to his full capacities. He's not a farsighted thinker. He's sort of found himself in a situation which, you know, I think perhaps beyond his capabilities. But on the other hand, his instincts seem to be right, yet he's unable to really make a break with some of the past in Pakistan. He talks a good game, and perhaps the best measure of his performance is that the Islamists are very much against him because he remains in power. But Pakistani liberals, moderates and liberals, are really divided about him. A lot of them actually believe that he is Pakistan's last hope. So others believe that he's just another general who's come along to intervene in politics and is not doing the country any good. So that's why I give him a middling grade, not neither a high grade or a low grade.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly is a difficult position in the sense that there are a number of competing interests and powers that he can't completely alienate them, but he can't completely satisfy them either.
Yeah, he has one great asset, and that is, nobody wants him to really fail, except a few radical Islamists. The Chinese don't want him to fail. The Chinese want stability in South Asia, and China, of course, is Pakistan's major military supplier. The Saudis don't want him to fail. They, of course, they poured a lot of money into Pakistan. The Americans don't want him to fail because we see him as a bulwark in the so-called war on terrorism. And even the Indians now, who really don't like him at all because he's the man who invaded across the line of control. They don't want him to fail because they're afraid, I think quite correctly, that if Musharraf goes, there might be chaos in the country. And then who knows who would control Pakistan's loose nuclear weapons at that point.
Hmm. Recently, the Pakistani army has been involved in fighting against al-Qaeda or people who are said to be al-Qaeda in the areas there. In the border between the two countries, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, it's also said that in the past, the Pakistani army was involved in supporting the Taliban because they were interested in having a regime that they could perhaps control or at least have influence.
That's right.
Over
right.
Next in the country and next door. So given the fact that there was that support for the Taliban in the past and now Pakistan is actually fighting against al-Qaeda and perhaps also some remnants of Taliban. Where does the Pakistani military stand? Yeah, and what exactly is going on?
Well, that's a mystery. I mean, I haven't been to Pakistan for some time. I'm going for a couple of months, for at least for almost a year. I'm going back very shortly. But there are little bits and pieces of evidence. And in the book, I discuss some of these, but others have just come to light, which make you wonder exactly what's going on up there. That is, this large area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, straddling the border where Osama and other al-Qaeda presumably took refuge, and also the leader of the Taliban, the leaders of the Taliban are located. Now, Musharraf said that Osama was up there, that al-Qaeda leadership was up there. And they let it be known that a high-value target was located in the area, in Pakistan, adjacent to Afghanistan. And then shortly afterwards, the Pakistanis launched a military operation in that area. Now, just two weeks ago, the corps commander for that area, General Safdar, said, there's no Taliban up here and there's no al-Qaeda up here. He said, we've gone through the area, we've combed it, can't find anybody. There's been other newspaper reports that the Americans are reducing their presence in Pakistan. You know, we have at least two military bases in Pakistan, and from which we've been flying combat missions and other kinds of operations in Afghanistan. And these apparently are being redrawn down in number. So it could well be that everybody's decided that there's no al-Qaeda up there after all. There's, of course, Osama has not been caught. And from looking at the video, it doesn't look as if he's hiding in a cave someplace. That film was probably taken in a studio or at least a house somewhere, either in Pakistan, my guess is, probably in the Middle East. So I think that this war on terrorism may be winding down for Pakistan. And the purpose of the book really is to look to the period after the war on terrorism, or the so-called war on terrorism, when we don't need Pakistan strategically, when Pakistan plays no significant role in Afghanistan or in Taliban or al-Qaeda related issues. But then we're still going to have to deal with Pakistan. And I think the major argument of the book is that the next American administration, whether it's Bush 2 or Kerry, we'll find that out tonight or tomorrow, perhaps in a week from now if the courts handle it, that they're going to have to deal with a Pakistan that's far more dangerous, far more important than we ever dreamed it was, and which would make Iraq look like child's play. Mm-hmm. I think that's the burden, the major argument of the book.
As I remember it, this most recent tape of Osama bin Laden, someone dropped it into a letterbox in Pakistan. So some people, I suppose that led some people to leap, and I don't know why that should necessarily should be the B, but to suggest that, well, perhaps he was in Pakistan. Do you think that that's possible, or it's not likely?
If he's in Pakistan, I don't know. It's like trying to predict the election, you know, tonight. Yeah, and yeah. I just wouldn't want to come down on one side or the other side. But there's enough evidence to indicate that he's possibly not up in that area, that mm-hmm. he may either be in a major Pakistani city, which raises other questions, or else simply outside of Pakistan completely. Or else, you know, other people have proposed that he's actually in safekeeping by the Pakistan government. I don't believe that. I think if they had him, they would turn him over, and they certainly wouldn't allow him to make those kinds of tapes. So it's still a mystery, and the big issue is whether, if he is not there, then what our relationship with Pakistan becomes, because I think the al-Qaeda threat is really diminished and was perhaps exaggerated to begin with after we took most of their facilities out in Afghanistan. But clearly Pakistan's capabilities have not diminished. They're acquiring more and more nuclear weapons, and as a state, there's a potential for it to be extremely unstable, I'd say, in the next 5 or 6 years if things don't turn around.
We're a bit point here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Stephen Cohen. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and before that was faculty member here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's one of the founders and former director of the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. His most recent book is titled The Idea of Pakistan, and it's published by the Brookings Press. Also, back in 2001, he wrote a book about India titled India Emerging Power. That's also published by Brookings, and has done a lot of other writing over time about the politics of both India and Pakistan. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Going back to the beginning, and when I just talked about the fact that there are a lot of people who do have concerns about Pakistan and regard it as a potentially difficult and dangerous place. One of the reasons that they do is that it is home to a number of radical militant Islamist groups that seem to pose some sort of a threat not only to the stability of the country, but also to the possibility they'd be involved in terrorist activity outside of Pakistan. What is important to know about them, and also about those two concerns, both the challenge to the government of Pakistan and also the possibility that they would move out and would be involved in terrorist activities outside of Pakistan?
Yeah, David, I don't think that the groups that exist today are really a great threat to the United States as such. I mean, some of them are very hostile to America, but on the other hand, others get along quite well with the U.S. and have no real problems with us. They may dislike us because of our Middle East policy or for our support for the generals in Pakistan, but other than that, there's no significant anti-Americanism among those groups, so all of that does... Yeah, that's saying a lot. To me, the group that I'm most concerned about in Pakistan are not the organized radical Islamic groups, but the potential Pakistani counterparts of al-Qaeda. If you look at the social economic class of al-Qaeda, it turns out that almost all of them were educated. Very few of them were extremely, you know, very few of them you could say were belonged to radical Islamic groups as such, but they were recruited along the way into a sort of a Salafi, sort of simplistic Islamic radicalism. They were recruited both in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, also in Europe, a lot of other places. And to me, the group to look out for and I'm most concerned about in the long term in Pakistan are those educated Pakistanis who feel that their life is not going anywhere, that immigration doesn't seem to play a role, that the U.S. is the chief enemy of Pakistan and of Islam, and who turn to radicalism in order to take their revenge both on the Pakistan government but also against the United States. For example, I met a young woman in Islamabad a couple of years ago, and she was working for a foreign organization. So she was highly westernized, educated in the West. And she looked at me. We were having a meeting together at an evening dinner. And she said to me, you know, Professor, if I had to wear a chadar, if I had to become an Islamist, I would if I could get rid of you, that is the American government, and get rid of this government, that is the Pakistan government. So she was a potential, I won't use the term radical, but a potential recruit for an al-Qaeda-type organization. And there were ties between al-Qaeda and some middle-class Pakistani professionals. Al-Qaeda was seen as sort of a sympathetic, proper organization by few Pakistanis. And what concerns me the most is that if Pakistan's social and economic civilizational qualities continue to deteriorate, then you'll see the rise of al-Qaeda movements as well as more simplistic madrasa-based radical groups. And there's been a lot of talk about the madrasas in Pakistan, how they teach hatred and so forth. And that's true. You know, that is a problem, and it's a significant problem, but mostly for Pakistan. But I'm more worried about the educated Pakistani elite, the children and the grandchildren of the elite of Pakistan, who if they decide that Pakistan is being abused by the Americans, abused by the generals, that radical Islam or some kind of radical movement is the way out, then I think those people could become a threat, obviously, to a lot of different countries. Analogous, perhaps, to the Red Brigades and the other group, the European radical groups of the 1960s, 1970s.
Hmm. I think we see people like that also other places who really, because of economic stagnation, the limited possibilities for their futures, become despondent and turn to these kind of radical groups because they don't see any particular future for themselves. Do you see, and I guess I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the economy in Pakistan, which is something we really haven't talked about at all here, and about what life is like, say set politics aside. Well, maybe you can't set politics aside, but other than that, talk about what life is like in Pakistan in other sorts of ways, how the country is doing, what its economic health is, and does that connect with the country's politics?
Yeah, I'm not an economist, but I took a stab at writing a chapter on the economics and these other demographic variables and hope it holds up. I've had many of my friends read it and offer comments. You know, what's happened is that Pakistan was on a wild spending spree for many years, under the years of democracy. Pakistan had 10 years of imperfect democracy where Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto alternated as prime ministers, and they just spent the country into the ground. It was catastrophic. Pakistan was billions and billions of dollars in debt, and what happened when Musharraf came in is he did appoint Shaukat Aziz as his financial advisor, and Shaukat Aziz, who's now prime minister, has really dug Pakistan out of this hole. He did it through good fiscal management, good economic practices, yet the economic growth in Pakistan is still very slow, and a lot of it is very uneven, and Pakistan's per capita income has actually slipped behind that of India. And Pakistanis look across the border to India with amazement and envy as to why India, which was a much poorer country, has suddenly zoomed ahead, especially in the high-tech areas. And that's one of the great tragedies of Pakistan. It had that opportunity of being a middle-income country, and they've just squandered both by, I'd say, the Zia regime, by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto before him, and also by 10 years of incompetent democracy. So Musharraf does get credit for trying to straighten out the economy. But again, you know, you can quibble with him and quarrel with him on some particular policies, and it may well be that it's too late. You know, the frightening thing is that it may be too difficult to pull Pakistan out of a tailspin, that Pakistan can't catch up with globalization and internationalization and become a modern state in that sense of the word. That we'll just have to wait and see. But right now, the indicators are mixed at best.
All right. Well, we have a caller here to talk with. Others who are listening are certainly welcome to call in with questions here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in our line number one. Hello.
Hi. About Benazir Bhutto's regime, not just incompetent, but actually corrupt, and corrupt by, I think there was something about the privatization of the power system that was, she apparently got those villas or whatever places in London through dealings with a major company. But that was just because you were just talking about the economics. And
right, right, sure.
I don't know if you know the details of that. But I actually was motivated to call, and I apologize I wasn't on from the very beginning. So have you talked much about Pakistani-Indian relationships in this thaw? Did you start with that, and I missed that, or if you would?
No, we can get to that.
Well, the thing I wanted to ask, though, is are you still banned from India so that you – I mean, it would be helpful, I suppose, to be able to go there. How long is there institutional memory as far as the – I think you were – correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were persona non grata because of the book you wrote about the Indian Army, right?
No, that's not true at all.
It's
quite the other way around recently. I was banned from India. That is, no American scholars were allowed to come to India to do any significant research from about 1971 to 1973. And that was in revenge for the American support for Pakistan during the India-Pakistan War of 1971. So eventually the Indians relented and we all got in, although the kind of stuff we can study in India is limited. However, and in fact, I'm now the proud possessor of a 10-year Indian visa, so I can come and go as I wish. That's not a problem. I was also banned from Pakistan at one point. In the 1970s, I tried to go to Pakistan just to see the country, and I'd written a book on the Indian Army. I wanted to look and see what Pakistan looked like, and that was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's government that banned me from entry, or at least denied me a visa. Since that time, I've been coming and going to Pakistan without any problem either, and so at least in my case, I have relatively free entry into both countries. But you are right, I did have troubles in the past.
But it wasn't just you. So I thought it was about the book on the army. But,
no.
I guess I don't – I just – it's hard to sort out what's going on with the supposed thaw and pulling back from insisting on a plebiscite and all of that about Kashmir. What can the U.S. do to besides selling weapons to both sides, I suppose, to help out in that situation? I don't know if you would advocate that, but I'll just listen and let you
sure. Okay.
Go on.
Yeah,
no,
there is, for the benefit of the larger listenership, there's been going on for about 6 months now, very systematic dialogue between India and Pakistan over Kashmir and other issues, and this is a very, very good thing. I don't believe, if I had to bet money, I don't believe it's going to come to any kind of concrete agreement. In fact, this is all speculation. I suspect these talks will sort of break down and eventually there could be another crisis. But I do think that there's a new realization in India that it cannot afford to leave Pakistan collapse, that, you know, the old Indian desire of bringing Pakistan down might raise some significant problems for India, especially in terms of Pakistani retaliation. And I think there's realization in Pakistan that they've fallen so far behind the Indians that they may have to make some compromises on Kashmir. And Musharraf, you know, for all of his problems and weaknesses, and clearly there are many of them, has spoken more forcefully and openly about a new kind of Pakistani policy towards Kashmir. The trouble, and we don't know what the private negotiations are, but clearly they're moving ahead at least at some pace. The U.S. role in this right now should be just to sit on its hands and applaud, sit on its hands and say nothing, do nothing except encouragement. In fact, I think we should be more encouraging than we have been, but we're preoccupied with Iraq and other issues. So I think that my guess is that Washington will not take an active role in the India-Pakistan dialogue until and after the next South Asia crisis takes place. And I think there will be one. I think these things go in cycles, and I think that cycle is going to come around again. So when that happens, we'll probably be more active diplomatically. Perhaps at that time, we'll take a more open and active role in trying to bring the two countries to some kind of agreement. The real change, I think, has to be in Pakistan. Pakistanis have not really debated the issue of Kashmir for ever, and now Musharraf has triggered a debate in Pakistan among Pakistanis about alternative arrangements for Kashmir other than simple accession to Pakistan. That's good, but I don't think that's going to be enough, and I think the Indian debate is fairly well advanced. Sooner or later, the two countries will have enough diversity in their views where they can have negotiations about the future of Kashmir.
Mm. It's interesting. Certainly, President Musharraf made news with these countries. comments that he made recently. He apparently was talking with reporters and some diplomats. This was in Pakistan, and he talked about the need for a national debate over Kashmir. He said something to the effect that he'd never spoken like this to anybody anywhere before, and he went on and said things like, well, you know, maybe there are some things we ought to talk about, like the possibility either that the whole of Kashmir should be autonomous, or it could be somehow jointly administered by, I don't know how such a thing could be worked out, but jointly administered by both India and Pakistan. Yeah. And the Indians, apparently, at least the official response was rather cool to what he had to say, but it seems significant the fact that he said it at all.
Actually, David, the Indian response was significant in another way. They chastised him for talking about these things publicly, and they said, we want to talk about these things diplomatically and privately. But they didn't reiterate the old Indian position that Kashmir was an unalterably acceded to India. So in a sense, they could have been tougher than they were. And secondly, not only Musharraf, but other generals have said privately what he's now saying publicly. And they've said that to themselves, and they've said that to foreigners and to others, that the present situation is not good for Pakistan. Pakistan has to change its policies in some ways. And they're sort of groping around to find a politically acceptable alternative to stalemate or another crisis. And this is going to require a lot of debate and discussion in Pakistan. It's going to have to involve the Islamists. It's going to have to involve the liberals. And I think eventually it's going to have to involve the United States and other countries as sort of guarantors of whatever agreement that India and Pakistan do reach. And, of course, he's now talking about the Kashmiris themselves. And I think it's, to me, a solution which is based on justice, you know, in the broad sense of the word, is probably marketable in all three countries, because all three countries are somewhat – all two countries, rather, the India and Pakistan. They're embarrassed by what's happening to the Kashmiris. The Kashmiris themselves, of course, would like to get some relief from Indian military pressure and also terrorism sponsored by the Pakistanis. So I think there is room for an agreement. But in these kinds of things, it takes a long time. Attitudes have to change. There has to be clear inducements, clear guarantees of an agreement when it is reached. And I think we're probably early days in that kind of process. But I'm more optimistic about that now than I've been for many years.
All right. Let's talk with someone else here. Line number two. Hello.
Yeah. I have a small comment. The comment is that Pakistan is as dangerous as any other nuclear power. And the mullahs or the Islamists will not be responsible for it if it became dangerous. I think the masses are poor. They want to become rich as anybody else wants it. And we are denying them this opportunity by supporting corrupt regimes, whether they are civilian or whether they are army people. We have been supporting them because we want to have some quick fix to the problems. We have not taken care of the corruption. We have not taken care of the exploitation. Now, we can say, hey, this is not our business. But they become our enemies because they expect too much from us, I think, from the Americans. Any other comment from you? Maybe I'll
just... That's actually very sound insight. I like that very much. I think I should steal it. They become our enemies because they expect too much from us. And I think that's actually quite true in the case of Pakistan. Pakistanis have expected a great deal from the United States, you know, far more than any American government's been prepared to offer. And I think our relationship with Pakistan has been sort of a fairy tale relationship for many years. We promise a lot to them. They promise a lot to us. And it hasn't been put on a sound, realistic basis. I think it is time now for the U.S. and Pakistan to have an agenda. And in that agenda should be the salvation of Pakistan. Because I agree with the caller that Pakistan could be an extremely dangerous country to the United States and to itself and, of course, to India. In a sense, a lot of countries no country wants Pakistan to fail, except perhaps for a few Indians, because a failed Pakistan would be a catastrophe for all of its neighbors and I think for the United States. But on the other hand, how do you get a country to succeed if it doesn't want to do it or if it doesn't know how to do it? That's a dilemma of Pakistan.
Well, I thank the caller. Let's go to someone else here. This would be our line number one. Hello.
Hello, yes?
Yes.
Yes. I have two or three comments here. One is that Professor has given a clean chit to LAT operatives. I mean, basically, he said that the extremist terrorist organizations of Pakistan are not dangerous to U.S. or anybody else. I mean, he specifically said U.S. And we have seen LAT operatives. There was news that some of them were found in Iraq. They were arrested. And also, LAT operatives, I mean, some of the groups were involved in beheading of Pearl. And also, in if you remember, back in, I would say about 89, around that time frame, they got something like three people, and they beheaded one Norwegian. This was in Kashmir. So the terrorists are a danger. So the professor here is giving a clean chit to the terrorists. And the
let me interrupt the speaker. I didn't say. I said that they were not a threat to American interests.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they've targeted American individuals, including Pearl,
yes,
and LAT in particular, Lashkar-e-Toiba.
Okay.
It's one of the most notorious groups. So I think you've exaggerated my comments a bit, but I agree with your point in terms of their threat to American citizens and foreigners generally in South Asia. Yeah.
Okay. The second point is that the 1971 India-Pakistan war, it had happened because of the brutal oppression of the then East Pakistanis by West Pakistanis, the current Pakistan. And at that time, Bangladesh was created, and our policies were wrong at the time in that we turned a blind eye to the killings of nearly 10 million of East Pakistanis. Okay? And that was a... India had a very, very huge... problem of refugees, war refugees streaming into West Bengal, the state of West Bengal.
Right.
And
yeah.
So essentially, I mean, it would be helpful to mention that basically when you say that 1971 India-Pakistan war, you just abbreviated that. But the real fact of the matter is that Pakistan was oppressing and they killed 10 million people. At that time, it was a huge program. It was even bigger than what had happened in Second World War by the Hitler. Then the third... third point is that we should not be helping Pakistan anymore than what we have done already. Because, I mean, they are getting... I mean, what? They got something like $3 billion or $4 billion during Nixon era. Nixon and before that, after that, Reagan too, to some extent. And then now we are helping them by another $3 billion. And they have been nothing but unhelpful, and they are the ones who actually started Taliban. They are the ones who created the Taliban, and now they want to actually have a big say in the Afghanistan affairs even today. They
sure.
haven't learned their lesson, and they should not be... helped anymore.
Okay,
point. And previous caller, they said that, you and him, you agreed that Pakistan needs to be helped even more. And the thing is that is like you're walking on, on a city street and somebody comes and holds a gun to your head and asks your money and then you're going to give it to them.
I get the point.
We're getting kind of short on time, the caller has made a number of points, and I just want to give Steve a chance to respond.
Let me suggest to the caller that it took me 4 years to write the book, and I've studied Pakistan since 1971 or so. I'm probably 1968. And so there's a lot more in the book than I've been able to talk about here. He's absolutely correct that the 1971 war was triggered by the event, ultimately by the oppression of the East Pakistanis. In fact, I supported India and opposed America in that war. But there were not 10 million people killed. There was far fewer than that, and it's certainly not comparable to the Holocaust and World War II. But he is correct in terms of Pakistan's initiating that war in the military through the oppression of the East Bengalis. In the case of American aid to Pakistan, I do think we need a significant aid package for Pakistan, but it should not be a military aid package, and it should be an aid package which is geared to Pakistani performance and to the reconstruction and reformation of Pakistan. And in fact, most Indian government officials that I've talked to would agree with that. They have no problems with a Pakistan that accepted its role in South Asia as a moderate state at peace with India. And but if we followed the caller's logic, we would shut off Pakistan. We would isolate it. We would contain it. We try to destroy it. Now, if Pakistan were a weak country or Pakistan had no nuclear weapons, that would be a reasonable strategy. The book spends a whole chapter looking at alternative strategies. But I would hate to be living in New Delhi or Bombay if Pakistan were destroyed, because I would want to know where those 50, 60, or 100 nuclear weapons the Pakistanis control are going to wind up. And I'd hate to be in New York, for that matter, or Washington, because a truly radical Pakistan could slip those weapons to terrorists and could use them around the world. So I think that Pakistan is like North Korea, that it's acquired nuclear weapons far more than North Korea. And while we don't like it and we may oppose it and we're angry that it got to that stage, we cannot deal with Pakistan as if it's a trivial country. It's got to be – its nuclear weapons are important, and we have to find strategies to turn it back into a more moderate state. And that's the argument of the book. I understand the caller's concern, but to stereotype Pakistan as a hopelessly rogue state I think is wrong, because many, many liberal Pakistanis, many sensible Pakistanis, even some in the army, I think Pakistan has the material to become a moderate progressive state, even and a good neighbor of India, for that matter.
Hmm. We'll try real quick here, line two, sure. and get another caller. Hello.
Yes, a while back, David had an interview with a scholar that was here. I was talking about the water policy and the situation in Pakistan, and it said that rivers were controlled by India, that they somehow dams have been diverted, or I'm not quite sure all the details. But since there's little time, I'll just say, do you think there's any hope of relief for the Pakistani economy or their agricultural system? He seemed to think that it was a dire situation that was going to have profound effects on the economy. And if nothing is done, no agreement is reached, what would be the effect on the future in terms of peace or the radicalization of Pakistanis?
Yeah. Yeah. I can answer that very briefly. Pakistan and India have an agreement, the Indus Water Treaty, which is internationally guaranteed, and by and large it's worked very, very well. It's enforced by the UN, there's a whole international apparatus connected to it. That's worked well. What the next step has to be energy, and India is an energy-short country. Pakistan is now increasingly energy short. There's a lot of energy in Central Asia. The best way to get it to India is through Pakistan, through pipelines. And I would hope that the next stage in India-Pakistan relations will be the opening up of gas and oil pipelines that transit Pakistan, but also have some stoppage in Pakistan, and that India will in turn export oil, refined oil and products to Pakistan. I think that would be a major step forward. That would be as important as the Indus Valley Treaty and significantly tie the two countries together. Both countries are also water short, and here again, there may have to be some large irrigation projects which would require the cooperation of both countries.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. If people are interested in reading more on Pakistan, you can look at the book that I've mentioned, The Idea of Pakistan, by our guest Stephen Cohen. It is published by the Brookings Institution Press. Steve Cohen is a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution, also author of another book if you're interested in reading on India, that book titled India, Emerging Power, published by Brookings in 2001. Thanks very much once again for giving us some of your time.
Great to be with you, David. Appreciate it very much. Thank you. Bye.
Our programming today made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana for over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. The broadcast also made possible with funds from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. That's it for us on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with historian Joseph Persico about his latest book, which is about World War I, 11.